Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, is Arizona's new turquoise alert working? A new report says it's only been activated once.
And could universal mental health screenings in schools help address the mental health needs of kids across the country?
But first, a Syrian national being held in an Arizona detention center could be sent to a third country. Kamel Maklad fled the civil war in Syria and went to Venezuela. But when his work and residency permit expired, he had to leave that country. He crossed the border from Mexico into Arizona in 2023 and surrendered to Border Patrol agents for the purpose of claiming asylum. He's been held in detention ever since, except for a brief time when he was sent back to Venezuela, but officials there wouldn't accept him and sent him back to the U.S. Emily Bragel, border reporter with the Arizona Daily Star, has spoken with Maklad and documented his story. She joins me now to talk more about it. Emily, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
So this is quite a convoluted tale, but it sounds like basically Maklad went from Syria to Venezuela to the U.S. to Venezuela back to the U.S. and now he might be headed somewhere else.
That's right. He's pretty confused about what the future holds for him at this point. He has been in detention now for more than 2 years, and that's even after an immigration judge granted him withholding of removal back to his home country in November of 2024. Now, withholding of removal, it's a lesser form, a more limited form of protection than asylum, but it actually has a higher threshold for it to be awarded. And that means the judge agreed he'd face threats to his life, most likely back in his home country. But under the Trump administration, people with this form of protection are more vulnerable to being deported to a third country. The Trump administration is aggressively trying to find more countries to accept deportees who aren't their own citizens. In this case, they probably thought of Venezuela because Maklad had lived there before. He learned Spanish there over his 10 years there. But when he arrived there, he spent about 30 minutes in the airport. Officials there were very confused. They said, "You're not Venezuelan. We never agreed to accept you." And they turned him away. So that same day, within under an hour, he said, he was back on the same plane headed back to the U.S.
Wow. So I want to read a quote that Maklad gave to you when you spoke with him, which sort of goes to how he's doing. He said, quote, "I have no energy anymore. I have no desire to fight. I feel finished. They stole my time, my life." That doesn't sound like somebody who is in a good place.
That's right. And I talked with also a volunteer who regularly visits detainees at Eloy, and she's been visiting him for almost a year. And she says she's very concerned about Maklad's mental health, just this indefinite nature of his detention, not having any idea really the reason, if he could be sent to a third country soon or if he could be locked up for years more. He's reaching the breaking point, he told me.
Well, and you mentioned his status from the federal government, and that seems important for a number of reasons, but especially because the federal government is now saying that he's a suspected terrorist, and that's why they're keeping him in detention?
Yes. Yeah, so this came out of nowhere, his attorney said. I talked to three attorneys, his current and two former attorneys from Maklad, who said DHS has never accused him of being a terrorist before, even in all these court proceedings, including the hearing when he was awarded withholding of removal, which would not have been possible if they believed him to be a terrorist. But DHS, in their statement to me, they did not respond at all to my questions about the attempt to deport Maklad to Venezuela. They just ignored that. They just sent this statement claiming for the first time that he's a suspected terrorist, and that's why he's being detained.
In fact, Emily, you spoke with one of Maklad's attorneys, as you mentioned. This is Luis Campos. Let's hear what he had to say about this.
The government attorney at that time could have said, "Your Honor, he's not eligible for any relief because he's a suspect terrorist." If they had the evidence, or if they had that argument in their pocket at the time, they would have made the argument, provided the evidence, and then he would have not been given the relief by the judge that he was requesting.
Well, and Emily, as you say, DHS hasn't really answered your questions. It sounds like it hasn't really answered the questions that his attorneys have either.
That's right. And I did really press them via email for greater explanation of all of this. I think it's very incumbent upon us journalists to do our best to independently corroborate any of these claims, especially when they come out of nowhere like this. After I pressed back in response to that statement, I did get a call from just spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin, but she would only talk on deep background, she said. She would not talk on the record. And I declined, which is a judgment call, but I think here that granting anonymity to a top DHS official under these circumstances doesn't serve the public interest. I think the public and McLeod really deserves to understand why he's being detained.
So what are his lawyers' next steps at this point?
It could be. Well, one thing that they're a little concerned about, we see DHS will sometimes suddenly move detainees to other locations, for example, in Louisiana, where these detention centers can be very remote and cut people off from their legal representation. Or maybe they'll find a third country. And in fact, McLeod would be at this point, he just doesn't care where he is. He just wants to be out of detention. But if he, as it seems, he's facing another long stay, and his attorneys may be able to file a habeas corpus petition, that is the right to go before a judge and have the legality of your detention evaluated by a judge. So that could be the next step. But at this point, they're not sure.
Well, you say he really obviously wants to be out of detention. Is he potentially interested in going to one of these third countries?
You know, to always, if before they deport someone to a third country, they're supposed to give them a chance to raise a fear claim and say, no, I would also be in danger in that third country. We're hearing a lot of concerns from advocates that that is not happening. But McLeod said that he did agree after DHS assured him that he would be accepted by Venezuela, would be able to get legal standing there. He did agree to be sent back to there. But of course, he was rejected. And I think, yes, at this point, he would probably agree. He said to me that he would rather be incarcerated or even dead back in Syria, because at least he'd be with his family.
Wow, that is not a great situation. All right. That is Emily Bragel, border reporter with the Arizona Daily Star. I'll keep looking out for more reporting. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
We've probably all gotten an Amber Alert sent to our phones when there's been a child abduction, or a Silver Alert when there's a missing older adult. But here in Arizona, we've only gotten one Turquoise Alert, a new kind of emergency alert designed by state lawmakers to close gaps in the system when a missing person doesn't meet the requirements of either of those other alerts. This happened, though, even as nearly 300 people were reported missing in Arizona since the Turquoise Alert was launched. The legislation was dubbed Emily's Law at the state legislature, as lawmakers cited the case of Emily Pike, a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe who went missing from a Mesa group home earlier this year and was later found brutally murdered. But our next guest reports even her case wouldn't qualify for a Turquoise Alert. Chelsea Curtis is a reporter for Arizona Luminaria who covers missing and murdered indigenous people here. Good morning, Chelsea. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So tell us first just what this Turquoise Alert was supposed to do. Who's it supposed to be for?
Yeah, so initially when the measure was proposed in the legislature, it was proposed as an alert specifically for indigenous people because indigenous people historically have faced high rates of violence and number of disappearances. And so this was meant to address that. And eventually it was amended. It was amended to include everybody, so not just indigenous people, and then to have an age limit of 18 to 64. Mm-hmm. And at the time they started, lawmakers promoting the measure started tying Emily Pike's case to this as an example of one they hope to prevent in the future. Mm-hmm. With this bill. And this alert. But I recognize that Emily Pike is 14 and the age parameters were 18 to 64. So that automatically would have disqualified her from having this alert.
Right.
When I spoke with Representative Teresa Martinez about this, she wound up making a change to that and changing the age limit to all minors up to 64. But again, it still begged the question of, you know, if Emily would have still qualified for this alert because her case wasn't deemed suspicious, she was labeled a runaway.
Right.
And there wasn't a factor of danger, according to the missing persons report. So,
right, which is all kind of in the specific criteria that the alert requires in the legislation. There's a difference here, it sounds like, between a runaway, as Emily Pike was labeled, and a missing person. But you report that there are a growing number of experts who kind of say that anybody under the age of 18 who goes missing should be considered, you know, endangered.
Yes, yes. According to my, you know, research through this, yeah, there are a growing number of experts that do say that any missing child is a child in danger. And not only that, but a lot of children who are runaway are more prone to getting into dangerous situations. Mm-hmm. And so if anything, they're more at risk.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the fact that it's only been used once since July. The Department of Public Safety told you this is by design?
Yes. Yes. They said that it is by design, that they are following the law, and the law requires that all of the criteria be met, which is that first there's a report filed with law enforcement databases. The person is under 65. There's an element of suspicious circumstance, unexplained circumstance, and, you know, the danger factor.
Yeah.
And so they say that, you know, there's nearly 300 people in Arizona missing since July, since this launched. And they say none of them met all of those criteria. So they say they're following the law, that it's working as designed, and that filing or putting out an alert for every single case would likely desensitize the public.
Sure. Yeah. A fair argument to make. How does all of this relate to the tackling the epidemic in this country of missing and murdered Indigenous people, which you've covered for so long, Chelsea? Like, we know that Indigenous children go missing at much higher rates. Is this addressing that problem from your reporting?
Just based on my reporting, no. It, you know, raises the question of, you know, if this was the alert that was supposed to help a lot of these children who are going missing, by bringing attention to their case a lot sooner and helping locate them a lot sooner, but it's only been used once, then you know, how is it helping? Mm-hmm. And would people like Emily, children like Emily, is that still happening? What is the answer?
Yeah. Okay. Are law enforcement officers trained in how to use this alert?
Yes. DPS did tell me that they have done several outreach sessions, some virtual sessions with law enforcement across the state, not only on the Turquoise Alert, but their alert systems in general, just to tell them, you know, how, you know, the criteria for all of them and how to submit a request to their office, which is like a packet. Mm-hmm. With all of the information, and they then put it through a rigorous review process, and from there make a determination. But they are doing outreach. They say that continues.
Yeah. Okay, so just going forward then in the last minute or so here, Chelsea, tell us, like, where you think this leaves us. Like, it is this kind of alert, or what else might be needed, I guess, to try to tackle this issue that continues where Indigenous children are still going missing at such disproportionate rates?
Yeah, that's actually what I'm working to answer right now. Looking for some experts to maybe shed some light onto this. My initial research is pointing to more investment in research or resources that sort of try to prevent this from happening from the beginning. Whether that's you know, more family assistance or counseling, although again, super early stages of what exactly that looks like.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like lots still to watch for here.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Chelsea Curtis, reporter for Arizona Luminaria, joining us. She covers missing and murdered Indigenous people. Chelsea, thank you for your work. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the healing power of metal music.
This is a story I felt strongly that I really wanted to share with people.
How a young metalhead found her voice.
But first, starting next school year, students in Illinois will undergo annual mental health screenings. A bill signed into law earlier this year makes Illinois the first state in the country to require the screenings, although parents are able to opt their kids out. There is a lot of concern about the state of mental health among children in this country. The State of Mental Health in America 2025 report finds, among other things, that while the percentage of young Americans who'd experienced a major depressive episode in the past year decreased from 2023 to 2024, more than 11% of those between the ages of 12 and 17 did experience one. With me to talk about that and whether the idea of mandatory mental health screenings in schools could bring those numbers down is Marilyn Cabe, a clinical psychologist in private practice and former school psychologist. And Marilyn, what do you make of this idea being tried in Illinois?
It's a complicated issue, and schools are doing a lot already. To go in and additionally require schools to add another screening, which in a sense is another way of evaluating somebody, I think poses some concerns. Are these screening tools actually going to be accurate, valid? I know there's a lot of research that goes into developing assessments, but we have unique communities in each of the schools. What do we do with that information? There's certainly going to be a cost involved to adding that. And I might backtrack and say that schools are already required to do a screening of academic and behavioral health to identify children who might potentially have or be eligible for being evaluated to have a disability that could affect their education. So I don't know at this point if adding an additional screening would tax an already stressed system as far as resources go.
Let me ask you about what you were saying about what happens with the data. And I wonder, even if the screenings do a good job and identify students who maybe have behavioral health or mental health needs, are there the services available for those students and their families? Like, or is it just a matter of saying, okay, this is a student who needs some help, you should go find it?
That's a real concern, because we have a shortage of mental health providers nationwide. With what we have here in Arizona, for instance, the ratio of how many psychologists to students that is recommended is one psychologist to 500 students in schools. And right now we have about one psychologist to between 1,300 and 1,500
Wow.
students. The number of counselors, the ratio compared to what's recommended is even much poorer.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot available within schools to provide those services. And then if you're referring outside of schools, there's also a shortage of providers. There's the providers that are taking insurance are even more limited, and then providers working with minors are more limited.
How accurate do you think these screenings can be? Like, is there a danger of having false positives or false negatives in this sort of thing?
Certainly there's a danger. You know, it's one thing to have a full evaluation and look at reports from parents and teachers and observe behavior of children and listen to their own self-reports and do assessments. But that is time-consuming and costly. Now, I understand there is a hope that in screening children, maybe they would be able to provide some sort of intervention that could benefit them prior to problems developing. But I don't know if that's actually been shown as being effective.
Well, what are the dangers to the students? If, for example, there's a screening given and a student is found to have name your condition, but they don't actually, what is the danger for that student in that?
Well, one way of describing it would be it could lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then there's also the problem with how parents or teachers might interact with students who are identified, especially if they're not necessarily clearly needing services. If they need support, and I don't want to, you know, disregard that schools are doing wonderful things to help children who do need and would benefit from some extra support. I'm just concerned that perhaps identifying kids with a screener might lead to over-identification.
Well, and I also would imagine that the manner in which the screening is done would matter, right? Like if it's a self-evaluation, you know, a student answers a bunch of questions, or a trained professional observing a student in class, and you kind of alluded to this, or even a trained professional sort of asking the questions and gauging the answers that the student gives, I would imagine that could influence the answers and the results as well.
Yeah, definitely it would. And I don't know that at this point they would even try to do something as far as a professional interacting with students. Back to what the resources are and what I've read about school screenings,
yeah,
it would probably be more like a checklist sort of screening. And I, as you know, probably physicians have been doing mental health screenings, mm-hmm, for children and adults, and that might not be that might be a good environment to do it. That might be the good place to do it because it's more private, it's more individual. There's a potential to talk about it.
Well, so I don't think I have to tell you about all of the research and the writing and the, you know, sort of the worry about the mental health of kids in this country right now. So is there a better way to try to get help to kids who need it, who maybe otherwise wouldn't be getting it?
I think all kids would benefit from learning and growing in their understanding of mental health and the importance of mental health. And I think that the country is actually moving in that direction. But I think as much as we can help students in schools understand that emotions are important, understanding and supporting each other is important, the serious impact of bullying or ostracizing, you know, the benefits of inclusion from learning from each other, those things would all be very helpful.
Well, what you're describing kind of sounds like sort of a universal education system almost to help students identify, you know, for example, how to not be unkind to each other, or maybe even something as basic as put your phone away and, you know, stop scrolling, yeah, social media, things like that, as opposed to a screening of their mental health. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're aware of some of the things that promote health, like, you know, we don't want to have students coming to school with food insecurity, with housing insecurity, things like that. Those are things that would be helpful to address within school, promoting social interaction, perhaps peer buddies. I think teachers would like to do that, but I also think that there's a lot of pressure on schools right now.
Well, do you anticipate that this idea of sort of universal mental health screening in schools, do you expect this to gain in popularity, or do you think it's going to continue to be sort of a one-off here and there?
I don't know. You know, I what I've seen is like in Illinois, it's been planned for the 26-27 school year. There's a lot of research going on in Wisconsin and in the New England states. Here in Arizona, do I expect it to take off? I would probably say not right away, you know.
Because of resources?
Maybe because of resources.
All right. That is Marilyn Cabe, a clinical psychologist here in the Valley. Marilyn, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Dating later in life isn't all that uncommon anymore if you find yourself single and of a certain age. But getting married later in life, that is still very uncommon, according to our next guest. Cassandra Cotton is a family demographer and sociologist at ASU. And in her newest study, she found a surprising trend.
Something that really struck me when I was talking to older adults about what kinds of relationships they were interested in was how striking it was that the financial piece mattered so much, especially in relation to their families.
And when she says families, she means their grown-up kids. I spoke with her more about it.
There was a particularly notable interview that I did with a 91-year-old who had been married a couple of times and was now in another committed relationship for something like 7 or 8 years. And he had been really surprised because his adult children got frantic when he got into this last relationship, something they'd never had a problem with before. And he was telling me he thinks it's all about the inheritance, you know, that they were really worried at this stage, if he started something new, that everything that they thought was coming to them probably relatively soon was suddenly going to be taken by a new partner. And that's what really got me thinking about how are people thinking about their money? How are they thinking about their family when they're making these kinds of decisions?
That's so interesting. So a lot of the sociological literature around this talks about marriage as a wealth building institution, right? Like you can have more wealth at the end of your life if you have been married during your life. But this is almost the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's almost as if people start thinking about marriage as a threat. Instead of marriage, you know, people coming together, pooling resources, all of a sudden there's the possibility that a new partner might take everything that you've earned over a lifetime. Mm. And so people would tell me things about not only were they worried about having enough money for the rest of their lives, you know, not wanting a partner to take what they needed for themselves, but they were worried about a potential partner taking what they felt really belonged, especially to their children. Mm. People would say things like, you know, me and my former spouse built this up over our life together, and that needs to go to my kids. I can't put that at risk by potentially marrying a new partner.
And it sounds like the kids also agreed with that sentiment.
It was striking to me how often people, you know, would reference specific things that their children had said. Mm. So like the 91-year-old I'd mentioned whose kids had been pretty vocal about it. Another woman who I had interviewed who was really set on marriage because she felt marriage was the right kind of relationship for her. But she had to go and plan out all of her estate and actually share the resources that she would have left to her sons with them before she died because they were so worried about who she was dating and they bothered her a lot about it.
That's so interesting. Okay, so you found in this research, which was, you know, interviewing a whole lot of people about this, right? Older people who were in or not in relationships. You found that they were kind of doing other things, like finding other ways to be in committed relationships that did not amount to a government-sanctioned marriage.
Yeah, and so we sort of use the term in this paper, one of our participants said, no government marriage. And by that, they were thinking things like spiritual marriages or living together or living apart together. And so lots of people I spoke to saw those as sort of the ideal, being able to structure relationships that still meant people knew they were committed. You know, people knew that those were important romantic relationships to them, but with some of this potential protection from a partner taking on all of their money, or conversely, them taking on all of a partner's debt. It was surprising to me, actually, the number of people who had done what we might kind of think of as a commitment ceremony or a spiritual marriage. And sometimes this came up in interviews in kind of a funny way, because I, for example, interviewed a couple who had told me when I called them to set up the interview, oh, we're married. But I got to the interview and each of them shared separately that they weren't actually legally married. It really surprised me in the moment because I guess they had decided they would present themselves to other people as married because they felt, you know, marriage was more official. People would take that relationship more seriously. But they, and especially the man's children, didn't want the hassle of any of the legal paperwork.
Does it amount to more than that in your research, Cassandra? Like, you're talking about people's children potentially being very upset about this, but is that what the law actually says in Arizona in terms of, like, if you marry someone later in life, they could take all of your money from before that?
Well, you know, this is what was so striking to me. And I am not a legal expert, but I had to sort of become a mini expert in this case because I realized people were telling me, you know, yeah, if we get married, you know, what happens to my house? Does that guy get to take my house if we get divorced? Does he get to take all the money for my children? And I think people have this expectation because most of us might know Arizona is what's called a community property state.
Right.
And when we talk about community property, what this typically means is that anything that's accumulated in marriage is shared by both of the people in that marriage. But it turned out That's actually not how community property works in Arizona, because people who are coming into a marriage, and this is really important in later life when people are entering a new relationship with a lifetime of accumulated wealth and resources, when you start a new relationship, everything you had up until that moment is called separate property. So it belongs just to you. It's only what people bring into a marriage or earn in the marriage that becomes community property. So it was really striking to me that many of the people I spoke to had this idea of what would happen that's not actually based on how the law actually works.
And you're looking at some additional research on that right now, right?
Yes, I'm actively now recruiting for a new study looking explicitly at some of these economic and legal dimensions of people's decisions.
So, I mean, if this were a younger couple looking at wealth in a marriage and whether or not to get married and how that wealth, you know, accumulates because of the marriage, I mean, you would just think about a prenup first, right? Was that an option for many of these couples?
It's interesting. People did bring up the possibility of a prenup, but it was all mostly women, actually, one man, but people who weren't in relationships yet. And so they were sort of thinking forward, what would I do if I met the right person? Mm-hmm. But none of the people who I spoke to who did get married had pursued a prenup. And all of the people who had pursued other kinds of things, so the commitment ceremony, spiritual marriages, living apart together,
yeah,
none of them talked to me about seeing that as a possibility that would still allow them to get married.
Okay. So, I mean, what's your takeaway here, Cassandra? Like, are you thinking that people, as they're considering relationships later in life, are maybe just more practical than people when they think about them earlier on?
I think there's probably some element of the practicality, right? And certainly the people that I talk to would talk about, you know, being able to draw on a lifetime of experience coming into relationships in later life. They felt that they saw things differently than maybe they had, you know, in their 20s or even in their 30s, where at that stage you're thinking, I have all of this left ahead of me and I'm going to build a relationship and a life with a partner. But for people who are thinking about it more in later life, there probably is some of that practicality of, I've lived this great life. I've built all of these resources and assets. And now I can have a relationship that maybe fulfills me in different ways without the legal paperwork of marriage.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right. Lots to watch for in your work, it sounds like. That is Cassandra Cotton, a family demographer and sociologist, assistant professor at the School of Social and Family Dynamics at ASU. Cassandra, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
No, thank you so much, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Our next guest is an Arizona musician with a fascinating backstory. Here's our co-host, Sam Dingman.
Last summer, I drove up to Flagstaff to meet singer-songwriter Sage Bond. We met up on the NAU campus. Sage had just graduated a few weeks earlier. She showed up wearing all black. Black jeans, black shirt, black boots. She had long black hair. And she was carrying a black guitar case containing a black acoustic guitar.
The first way I learned how to sing, I was probably like 10, practicing the Cookie Monster vocals in my bedroom and giving my parents an earful.
What are the Cookie Monster
vocals? The Cookie Monster vocals. Can I do it here?
Sure.
Or are you going to get the levels? I have the backup. It's very loud.
Sage first heard what she's calling the Cookie Monster vocals as a kid, growing up on a Navajo reservation in northern Arizona, not far from Tuba City. Her parents were huge music fans. Her mom used to sing R&B in the bathroom while she was getting ready in the morning. But her dad was into the hard stuff.
Thrash metal was something I heard a lot. Growing up, things like Metallica and Megadeth.
When Sage was 9 years old, her dad started bringing her around to rehearsals with some of the local metal bands on the reservation. Sage loved it.
I just wanted to touch every electric guitar I saw. I was like, everywhere I went, I was like, someone's playing a guitar. I would like to play that guitar also and take it away from them.
Sage's dad could tell she was a metalhead, and once she did get her hands on a guitar, he taught her everything he knew, which wasn't much.
The only thing he taught me was a power chord, and then that was it, and I took off from there.
It was enough to get her started.
I would come home after school, and other kids would be outside, like, getting on their bikes and riding around all evening, but I'd come home and plug in, turn on my amp, and sit there for like 2-3 hours before dinner's ready and just play.
Between the power chords and the Cookie Monster voice, Sage could tell she was on to something. And her mom could, too.
My mom heard me sing one day, and she was encouraged me to come to karaoke with her at our local coffee shop in Tuba City, and I was really nervous.
The first time she sang karaoke, Sage felt her whole face flush. But she got through it, and she started to love the way it felt to perform, even if people didn't always understand what she was doing.
After I would perform, people would come up to me and say, like, well, you should really sing in Navajo, trying to put me down about playing the white man's music. Like, if I play Iron Maiden covers somewhere, I'll get that comment. And I'm just like, this is me. Like, I am not a white man, and I am a Navajo and an Apache woman, and I'm playing these songs because I grew up with these songs, and I love the way they sound, and I love playing the songs that I like.
When Sage was in high school, a new teacher showed up to teach a songwriting class.
He was a metalhead, too, I could tell. his name's Michael Begay, and he was a part of the Native American Composers Apprenticeship Project, NACAP for short.
Having NACAP come to her school was a big deal. There wasn't much opportunity for music education on the reservation. Sage started bringing her guitar to Begay's class, and one day she was running through one of her power chord sequences, and Begay heard something he liked.
So I was just sitting in the corner, jamming my little thing, and then he looked up and he was like, wait, play that again.
Begay helped Sage organize the chords into a song, which meant adding lyrics. A lot had changed since she was a little girl going to band practices with her dad, and Sage had a lot of complex feelings she'd never really expressed out loud.
I knew I had struggled with depression for a long time. I just didn't know how to define it as a child. A lot of that was caused by my father. And once my dad left our family when I was 15.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And the dad that taught me my first power chord. And I had this, I felt so much confusion, like a lot of feelings of like being torn of how could this person like just give up getting through that. I could use music as a way to heal myself and really be vulnerable with myself and not lie to myself about like I'm tough and I'm strong and I'll be okay, and really sit with my emotions and putting it into words.
Sage didn't hold back. She even gave herself permission to write about her suicide attempts in middle school.
When I showed my mom, while I was writing a song about, like, holding my own funeral and stuff, that was a pretty heavy song, she got mad at me, like, oh my gosh, you're being so selfish. My grandmother was like, why do you want to talk about your family that way? Why do you want to talk about your dad and, like, put him down in that way? And I'm like, it's not my fault. He was, like, kind of awful. But this is a story I felt strongly that I really wanted to share with people.
Even if her family didn't understand at first, her classmates did. Other kids told Sage the songs made them cry. They told her their own stories of depression, and that made Sage want to keep writing. By the end of high school, she had enough songs for an album. She called it Prisoner.
I've been here before, got you way into my core. You know the craziness you live isn't to you.
The Prisoner LP was very satisfying to work on and create because it was a family effort.
As difficult as it had been at first for Sage's family to connect with her music, they started to come around. Her little brother drew the cover art for Prisoner, and eventually her mom got on board with an assist from Sage's recording engineer.
My stepdad recorded and mixed everything for me.
Oh, wow.
Who is Michael Begay? My my composition teacher mentor from NACAP. My mom saw him, and it was
Did they meet
from
through
then.
You?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he was teaching me, and then she would, like, come pick me up from school. And then she would be like, we should make more appointments with him. Like, we should meet with him, like, more so you can get, like, learn more. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And I didn't see what was going on. And then way later, I was like, why are they going to the movies together? And so he's still been a really cool mentor, and not just musically, but being a father figure and stepping up literally in that way.
And it didn't bother you that they got together?
For a bit, it did.
Yeah, of course. I can imagine it being confusing.
It was very confusing, and I was like, well, they like each other. I'm okay then. And yeah, so we're cool now.
Sage kept challenging herself to write more honest, personal songs. In 2020, she and her brother were watching news coverage of the murder of George Floyd by a white police officer.
And my brother was asking me that day, he was maybe 12, very small, and he asked me, like, why are the police doing that to that man? And it hurt, like, so much, and I hated having to tell him, like, this is the reality that some people of color face, and that we're not always safe.
Sage went to her room and started writing a song she called Truth.
See the world through my eyes.
After she posted the song online, Sage got a call from a woman named Dr. Zenaida Robles, who was working with a touring organization called National Concerts. Robles invited Sage to perform Truth live on stage in New York.
She was like, yeah, it's going to be at Carnegie Hall. So, and I was like, sitting in my room in like the middle of nowhere on the res, and I'm just like, Carnegie Hall. Like, oh, that's a huge place, isn't it? Like, it's a very well-known place that I've never thought I'd get to not just step foot in, but be on stage there and present my own song.
Sage brought her family with her to Manhattan for the show. And when she got back to Arizona, she took another big step and enrolled in the music program at NAU. Now that she's graduated, Sage is working on her next record. She hopes her story can inspire people back on the reservation.
Just something that will help kids like me that really want that outlet, that really want to just touch a guitar.
Not long after she started releasing original music, Sage joined a suicide prevention organization. She traveled around to high schools, speaking about her experience and performing her songs. She told me that during these events, she would always scan the crowd, looking for the kids dressed in all black.
At a lot of high schools, the metalheads are seen as like the outcasts. And
sure.
Yeah. So that was, I also went through that experience too, and so I'd reach out to, like, fellow metalheads and be like, hey, keep rocking.
What you say will never touch me. Lips of your mouth
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Mark will have your Friday news cap for you. And don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show, and you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radio Heads at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.